Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, Governor John Carney wants the State Department of Education to focus on support rather than regulation. We dig into what that shift may look like. Police departments across the state, including the one in Dover, see the state's opioid crisis firsthand on a daily basis.
I see it on a regular, hands down. You know, right on the front line, I see it. You know, I see it with the needle still in the arm.
We examine one part of Dover PD's response called the Angel Program. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also discuss family caregiver issues and the impact the House GOP's Obamacare replacement bill may have on older Delawareans with AARP's Vice President of State Advocacy. And we talked to an author who turned to Hagley Museum to tell the story of an industrial designer who helped develop the look and feel of radios and TVs over the years. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Throughout his campaign last year and here at the start of his term in office, Governor John Carney has emphasized the state's Department of Education will look much different under his watch. He has said he wants to pull back on DOE's regulatory work and instead, as he has said recently, quote, foster collaboration and build partnerships with local education agencies and between local education agencies, unquote. What exactly that will look like is still a bit unclear, but we do know that the person in charge of making it happen is Carney's choice for Education Secretary, former Indian River School District Superintendent Susan Bunting. Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast sat down with Bunting recently to get a sense of the direction she intends to take the department. His piece on what she had to say about DOE and some of the key issues it faces is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he learned.
We've heard Governor Carney talk about changing the Department of Education. It sounds like he wants to make a sea change in the way it operates. Is that an accurate read of what his goal actually is?
Well, sea change might be an overstatement. I mean, overall, and certainly it's early in his term, but Governor Carney thus far hasn't indicated a desire to do anything that might be considered dramatic. He's referred to the expected changes in the Department of Education as a reorganization, but it seems to me that it's more of a refocusing or a repurposing.
So what won't we see that we have seen in two terms under former Governor Jack Markell?
Well, during the Markell administration, the Department of Education took a lot of deep dives into complex statistics. Number crunching was often the rule as policy decisions were made. And our state education department was hardly alone in that regard. Education leaders nationwide were doing the same. But now, Susan Bunting, our new Secretary of Education, like so many others in education leadership these days, says that she is data-driven. So you can count on DOE to still seek precise measurements before it makes major moves. What will be different, however, is that Dr. Bunting, as a longtime Delaware educator and as a district superintendent in Indian River, has an understanding of how Delaware schools work, from the classrooms to the boardrooms, and she has the respect of the educators who are on the front lines every day. She's also big on communications and transparency. Those qualities set her apart from Dr. Mark Murphy, who was Secretary of Education during much of the Markell administration.
So having said all that, do we have a sense yet of what we will see in this DOE under Susan Bunting?
I think most significantly what we will see is a department that is more service-oriented. Back in the old days, and I'm talking going back to anywhere from the 1970s into the start of the Markell administration, the Department of Education was really a valued resource for school districts. There were curriculum specialists in just about every subject, and the districts could call on them for advice over the phone or to hold teacher training workshops whenever they saw a need for help in specific subject areas. Now, in the last 10 years or so, with the growing emphasis on standardized testing and classifying school performance and the talk about turnaround schools and priority schools and federal programs like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, all of that led the department to become an operation that was making more rules and was appearing to spend more time enforcing those rules than it was actually helping the districts and the charter schools to navigate through this new environment. So, you know, at least in terms of how the department interacts with the school districts, Susan Bunting hopes to turn back the clock a bit to make the department, in her words, more of a coach than a catcher.
And underneath that is perhaps a sense that there will be more of what school boards and districts desire, which is local control, that there'll be less, as you said, regulatory pressure from above, and the schools will make decisions themselves. For them, this style would appear to be very good news, starting with immediately the state's draft of the Every Student Succeeds Act plan, which seems to emphasize this as well.
Yes, that's true. But of course, when we talk about local control, some of the options are limited. Certainly, as far as the way federal funds are expended, the Every Student Succeeds Act state plan is going to be an improvement and a benefit to the districts. Dr. Bunning said the other day, we have the opportunity to go district by district now, and for the districts to determine how best to use those federal funds. What you need in Milford is not the same as what you need in Christina. So there is going to be more of a district by district look. The districts are going to have a little bit, certainly more autonomy in that regard. Looking at it more broadly, in this current environment, there are really some very severe limits on how local control can be exercised. You take the state's funding system, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. That pretty much specifies the staffing levels for districts and their schools. So it takes extra funds, which have to be approved by district residents in a referendum, to launch new programs. And we know how voters, especially those who don't have kids in the public school, feel about raising their own taxes. So if you look overall at the focus in the department and how it's changing, it's less about transferring control from the state to the districts, whatever that control happens to be, and it's more about DOE saying to the districts, let's work together to solve this problem, rather than saying to them, you've got a problem and you either fix it or we're going to come in and take over your school.
You mentioned school funding, and obviously it's something we've discussed a fair amount in recent months. The governor says he doesn't see, as we've discussed previously, money for assisting high-poverty schools through the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission's plan this year, and suggests that their districts turn to their federal Title I funding to help those schools. What is Susan Bunting saying about state dollars for schools, especially these high-need schools, particularly in the upcoming budget, which we know faces a pretty big deficit, $350 million.
Well, right now, Dr. Bunting is saying pretty much what the governor is saying. Don't count on the state for any more money for the coming year. And actually, for the coming year, you might wind up having even a little bit less. We'll know more about that in about 2 weeks when the governor presents his new budget to the General Assembly. Broadly speaking, I think Secretary Bunting is probably more sensitive to school funding needs and to the details of school financed than the governor might be, and I know John Carney is certainly an expert in most financial areas of government, but you can see a governor saying, when you've got a budget crisis like the one we have right now, that it might be a good idea for a district to go and reallocate its federal funds so it can somehow or other try to cover a possible shortage from the state. And that's pretty much what Governor Carney suggested last week at the meeting of the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission. But that's not the kind of position that a Secretary of Education would advocate for. I'm sure Secretary Bunting realizes that that's not a real solution to the problem, but when push comes to shove, if you ask her, she's going to say, this is something that we just might have to do this year to get through the coming year.
So as I say, it's something of a Band-Aid solution, but your piece does indicate that she is open to a long-term look at how state funds are used for schools and how the state actually decides how to distribute those funds.
Yes, I would say that Dr. Bunting, and really like most people in the education community, is willing to take another look at how the state's funding system works, particularly the unit system, which we have been using for about 70 years. That being said, Susan Bunting is not part of the chorus that is calling for a major overhaul here. She agrees that the unit system needs some tweaking. Maybe we should add some new categories. For example, categories for English language learners and children with low income from low income families, much as WEIC has been advocating. Of course, these sorts of changes, developing different weights for different types of students, has been and how the unit system has been modified and become more complex and more confusing over the years. The people who are advocating for greater education finance reform would like to see a system that bases funding more on an individual student basis rather than one that counts up students in different categories and then uses whatever that calculation is to determine how many teachers the state will support a district having. So, you know, there's a difference there. We are having a discussion. It hasn't reached to the fever pitch yet about how to reform the system. Tweaks are probably what will get the most interest right now, but they're probably not the long-term answer. But this is something that's going to have to be played out, not necessarily this year, but over the next couple.
The one area where perhaps some have discussed looking for some of the savings that might help make things cost less is district consolidation. And that is something that you did talk to Susan Bunting about. And tell us a little bit about where she comes down on consolidation, which is one of those areas that a lot of people seem to feel like, well, if we could shrink things down, save some money, then we would move into a larger discussion about funding.
First of all, my recent conversations on the consolidation issue started with a chat with Earl Jakes, Representative Jakes, who was chairman of the House Education Committee, and he said, you know, consolidation might be something that would come up this year, and Jakes has several ideas, nothing that he's got quite ready to go into the form of legislation. But the point is, Delaware has something like 137,000 students in 19 school districts and 20 plus charter schools. I did the math. It comes down to about a little more than 7,000 students per school district. Jakes tells me that there's something like school experts tell him that 22,000 students is a nice ideal size. You do that math, and Delaware ought to have 6 or 7 school districts. You run this by Susan Bunting, and you know, she says, yeah, we might have reason to at least look at this. She doesn't have many particular plans. She points out that, you know, there might be as many plans around as there are legislators in legislative hall, but she'd certainly be willing to look at, say, taking a couple of the smaller districts and consolidating them on a trial basis and seeing what happens. Now, you know, over the years, people have talked about consolidation as a way of saving money, and yet, when you look at it and you look at the principles that the state has followed in prior consolidations, one of the issues you come up with is leveling up teacher salaries, so the folks in the lower paying districts wind up getting paid the same as the higher paying districts that are involved in the merger. So there's really not a cost saving there. Whether you're talking about teachers or administrators, you might knock out a few more jobs, but overall the pay cost might go up. There have been some efforts at consolidating spending. The Brink Education Consortium, which is involved with technology and blended learning and the like, has expanded from 5 districts up to 9 now, and that's saving the district's money not in staffing at all, but in terms of bulk purchases of computers and IT equipment. So some of that is is also possible. So the savings, whether it's a savings issue or not, we don't know. Whether it's an efficiency issue or not, could be. The key thing that Dr. Bunting would be interested in is whether a consolidation is actually going to mean increased and improved opportunities for students. If consolidating districts means that students in high schools, for example, have better course selections and more options and greater opportunities to do whether it be an international baccalaureate program or advanced placement courses or whatever, if a consolidation would do that and it would and could work effectively, that's something that she would support. And she says it might take a dry run to see if that could happen.
And finally, left somewhat unspoken in all this talk of change at DOE is the fate of many initiatives that were launched under former Governor Jack Markell. Will much of the work done under his administration be undone or disappear as this change in focus comes about?
Well, I think we're going to find out in a couple of weeks. I mean, Dr. Bunting said that she's going to advocate at least for continuing a couple of the programs that that Markell started, the dual language immersion program, which starts kindergarten students on a path that could lead them through 13 years of instruction in either Spanish or Chinese, and Career Pathways, which is a high school experience that guides students towards jobs with high growth potential and financial rewards, areas like advanced manufacturing and healthcare, information technology, finance. Desire is to keep these programs, maintain them as they are, perhaps help them continue to grow. What we've got? Well, we'll know a little bit better in a couple of weeks.
Our thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week, and a reminder that his piece on the Department of Education under Susan Bunting's leadership is available online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, our James Morrison takes us out on the streets of the state capitol to learn more about the Dover Police Department's ANGEL program and its effort to divert opiate users from jail cells to treatment. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This past summer, the Dover Police Department teamed up with an addiction recovery center to divert opiate users into treatment, steering them away from crime, jail, or even death. And less than a year later, other police departments around the first state are looking at this partnership as a model they could adopt. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison takes us out on the streets of Dover to learn more about the ANGEL program.
Anthony Smith has been a patrolman for the Dover Police Department for the past 3 years.
This is an apartment door, right? The door is supposed to be secured.
Hey, what's up, man? Do me a favor, turn around, put your hands behind your back. Hands behind your back. You're not being arrested, you're just being detained.
He let me ride along with him on a recent Friday night to witness firsthand how widespread opiates are in Delaware's capital city.
If you look at this, that's a heroin baggie. It was popped at the top. Here's another one. You know what I mean? This is just the bags and things like that. Like what you were saying with earlier, as far as an epidemic, it's everywhere. You can just see it all day.
Smith says in a typical 12-hour shift, he receives an average of one drug-related call an hour, and that includes watching opiate overdoses firsthand.
I see it on a regular, hands down. You know, right on the front line, I see it. You know, I see it with the needle still in the arm. I see it. Somebody thought that this in particular subject was just sitting there asleep, and you roll them over, and rigor mortis done set in, and they have the needle still in their arm. So I see it. I see it a lot.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, opioid-related overdose deaths in Delaware have jumped by more than 300% in the past 15 years, and much of that spike took place in the past 5 years. And this tidal wave of opiate addiction hasn't just battered the police department. Alex Cropper manages Connection CSP's Dover Clinic, which provides methadone and drug counseling to opiate addicts.
Right now, we have close to about 400 individuals that come in each and every day. To get medication-assisted treatment.
But there are still opiate addicts in Dover who don't know this treatment exists, and that's why the Dover Police Department teamed up with Connections for the ANGEL program. Through this program, opioid users can surrender themselves and their drugs at the police department and get placed in treatment, not jail. The ANGEL program is modeled after a program that began in Gloucester, Massachusetts in the summer of 2015. Dover started its program a year later, and similar programs are now in more than 200 police departments across 28 states. And it could soon be in more police departments right here in Delaware.
Since we've put this in play with the Dover Police Department, I've had other police departments contact to get involved as well.
Cropper says Ocean View, Middletown, and Newark are just a few departments considering adopting the ANGELS program. Newcastle County started a similar program last year called Hero Help, and we'll most likely see a greater need for these type of treatment police partnerships in the future with more people getting hooked on opiates every day.
Good morning. Name and dose.
Simpson, 60 milligrams.
Thank you.
Yep.
Craig Simpson is 23 years old. He comes to Connections in Dover every morning before work to get his daily dose of methadone. He's been clean for about 6 months, and he's one of the dozen people who entered treatment through the ANGEL program.
I feel as though if I don't take the medicine, I probably would end up back out using heroin back on the street, because before I started taking it, I really was like at my wit's end and stuff. I had nowhere else to go, so I basically turned to the medicine, and it's been helping me ever since. And I think if I didn't have it, I'd probably be back using heroin again.
Simpson's aunt learned about the ANGELS program when he was in jail and immediately enrolled him. He admits he was reluctant at first and literally ran away from Cropper on the way to treatment. But looking back, Simpson says he's grateful for the opportunity to get his life back under control.
You either probably succumb to the drug, or you try to get help. And I'm trying to get help, so I don't want to do it. And I'm really hopeful about the future, and I think it's looking really good.
James Morrison, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And we have more to come on The Green, including an interview with AARP's Vice President of State Advocacy, Elaine Ryan, about work in Delaware to support family caregivers and the implication of the House GOP's Obamacare replacement bill for older Delawareans and Americans. But first, a check of your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. One of AARP's top national officials stopped in Wilmington Friday. The primary purpose for Vice President of State Advocacy Elaine Ryan's visit was to discuss family caregiving issues in Delaware and where they stand following lawmakers' passage of the CARE Act last year to address some of those issues. But this week, AARP has also been among the most vocal critics of the House GOP's Obamacare replacement bill, the American Health Care Act, complaining specifically about planned changes to Medicaid and the age rating provision that it says will raise insurance costs for those between 50 and 64. Ryan, who previously worked as Deputy Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association and the National Association of State Medicaid Directors, joined me after Friday morning's roundtable to discuss caregiving issues in Delaware and the move to replace Obamacare. Let's start with the Family Caregiving Roundtable you participated in Wilmington. What was the focal point there? What message were you and AARP hoping to convey to those dealing with this issue in the first state?
Well, today's roundtable was exciting and compelling. You know, there are 123,000 Delawareans who are family caregivers. And if you were to pay them for the care they provide, it would cost Delaware $1.6 billion in unpaid care. And so our discussion today was to strategize about ways we can give them support so they have the strength to carry on.
And when you say a family caregiver, what exactly are you talking about?
If you're caring for a loved one, a child, a returning war vet, a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, you're a family caregiver. And so many people, as they're going through the whole journey of caregiving, don't identify themselves as such and, frankly, don't understand they need support or the kind of supports that are available for them.
And this issue clearly is a growing one as the baby boomers age and retire. You talk a little bit about the supports and the infrastructure. Are they there right now to really handle this growing need?
Delaware has made some progress, but he has ways to go. We heard about the need for respite care services so caregivers can get a break or a way to easily find home help and aides to bring into the home. And also increasingly, I think the fact that family caregivers are performing medical tasks on behalf of their loved ones, but they have no idea of how to do it. So lots of challenges. Lots of room to make some changes here.
And that in part, particularly, I guess, the medical side and some of the things that the family caregivers are doing and performing, you know, medical-type procedures was what was addressed in the CARE Act, which lawmakers passed here last year. And AARP has been trying to get enacted in states around the country. How specifically does that address some of these issues you're talking about?
Well, it's exciting that the CARE Act here in Delaware took effect January 1st. And so we're hoping for a full implementation. It'll change things profoundly for people as they're going into the hospital. now families will be asked to identify a family caregiver to keep informed throughout the hospital stay. They'll be given some adequate notice prior to discharge. And I think most important, at discharge, they'll be offered an instruction of the medical tasks that they're going to be asked to perform on behalf of their loved ones at home. And so we're hopeful that as the law gets implemented, there'll be increased competency and at least peace of mind for family caregivers, that they know what they're doing and they can care for their loved ones safely at home.
Are there some more things that can be done on the legislative side to advance what's already been kind of codified in the CARE Act? Is there some more that can be done that you guys and others may be pushing lawmakers in the General Assembly to do?
Yes, you know, one thing we discussed today was nurse delegation. You know, Delaware is lagging behind other states that have already changed their laws that will allow a nurse to delegate medical tasks to home health aides. In other words, if you hire someone to come into your home to help with a loved one, in Delaware, they're not authorized to administer medication. So that family caregivers are hiring someone, they're going back to work, find out that the home health aide can't even give medications to their mom or dad. They then have to come back to the house to be able to give the medication. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we discussed about having changes that about 40 states have already made to allow home health aides to help with those kinds of medical tasks.
We talk a lot about these things, these logistical burdens that are put on family caregivers, the financial burdens that are on them. But there's also obviously kind of the emotional burden that they bear. Is there, first of all, is that something that needs to be talked about more? And are there things that can be done to help ease that load on caregivers?
You know, you just hit an incredibly important point and also one that came up at today's roundtable. The emotional toll family caregiving takes is a really an untold story. I think that what happens is that family caregivers get so wrapped up in caring for others, they forget to care for themselves. So we see that after a caregiving experience, a lot of family caregivers actually have medical crises of their own. Mm-hmm. They've let their health slip. They haven't gone to their own doctor's appointments. The stress has taken a toll. So things that can be done are to expand respite care services, to be able to allow family caregivers to just take a break from that sometimes 24/7 care they're providing. Those kinds of simple changes Delaware could make would expand someone to be able to come in for an hour or two into your home while you can go to the doctor, while you can go to the movies, while you can take a break to recharge. Simple changes like that could make a huge difference in the emotional stability and I think health of family caregivers in Delaware.
A very important topic, but I did also want to talk to you while we have you a little bit about the House GOP's Obamacare replacement bill that AARP has come out against this week. It would seem the AARP's concerns are primarily around the bill's impact on premiums for people between 50 and 64 through what's being called age rating and the bill's plans for Medicaid. I wanted to try to take them one at a time. First, can you tell us a little bit about age rating and what AARP's concerns are about what that may do for that 50 to 64 age group?
That's right. The House GOP replacement bill actually will change current law that will allow older workers age 50 to 64 five times the amount younger workers would be changed, or anything a state wants to charge. So they could charge 10 times more. At the same time, the subsidies in the GOP bill have been reduced. So it creates that perfect storm of having higher premiums for older workers and lower subsidies, which will dramatically increase the cost of insurance for older workers in this country. That's why AARP has come out so strongly against the age tax.
And that is certainly a group that has maybe not necessarily fixed incomes, but their incomes are fairly limited and their options for increasing their income are somewhat limited.
Well, I think that's right. And remember, during the Great Recession, many, many older workers lost their jobs and spent months, if not years, trying to find a new one. Now think of having employment, but now facing what could be for a 65-year or 64-year-old worker. We estimate that the increased cost under the House GOP bill could be as high as $8,400 more a year. That makes health care unaffordable and, frankly, inaccessible, and will result in fewer people getting coverage that they need.
And on the Medicaid front, I realize there's a lot of moving parts to the House GOP plan, but are there particular provisions that are most concerning to AARP?
Look, on Medicaid, it's another untold story, so thank you so much for asking about it. The GOP bill would cut Medicaid by $370 billion a year. And people don't know this, but that would be historically the largest cut ever in Medicaid in this country. The other piece of the story is that it cuts $116 billion for services for disabled children, disabled adults, and the poorest seniors in this country. Those kinds of cuts, we believe, will result in 17 million disabled children, adults, and poor seniors to lose access to their care, the most vulnerable people in our society.
And looping this back to our caregiving discussion, could the House GOP plan wind up not only having this financial impact you're talking about, but also in some ways put a greater burden on caregivers as some of these services perhaps become financially out of reach for some of these people you're talking about who would have benefits cut?
Oh, you're spot on this. I think that the types of cuts they're talking about for Medicaid, that $370 billion a year, for the bill's duration, which I think is a 10-year number, will transform that system of services and support for family caregivers in a good way, which means that they'll face fewer services to care for their loved ones at home. Nursing home care will be dramatically reduced. When you think about the totality of those cuts, that system of care that has been the safety net, an intergenerational safety net, will be shred by the GOP bill.
Thanks to AARP's Vice President of State Advocacy, Elaine Ryan, for joining me to discuss family caregiving issues and the move to repeal and replace Obamacare. And next on The Green, it's this week's Enlighten Me, and an interview with an author who used resources at Hagley Museum to tell the story of an industrial designer who helped shape the way people interact with TVs, radios, and other technology. That's coming up. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Many of you are listening to this show in your car, or maybe you're a little old school and listening on a radio at home. Either way, have you ever thought about your radio dial, how the knobs and buttons feel on your fingers? In this week's Enlighten Me, author Danielle Shapiro introduces us to the man who made radio and television a pleasure to interact with. She talks to our Mark Earhart about the life of industrial designer John Vassos and how the research library at Hagley Museum in Wilmington has unearthed his work.
The subject of your book, John Vassos, is a rags-to-riches story. Is that why you were so interested in his life and work?
Well, I thought he was an incredible figure through which to tell the story of how radio and new technologies became so welcome into the home. He was the lead designer at RCA when it was a major corporation, sort of like the Apple of its day, designing products across the board, all the kind of major mass media technologies of the 20th century he had a hand in, such as radio, television, computers, as well as broadcast equipment, TV cameras. So I thought he was a really interesting person through which to tell the story of design for mass media and media technologies.
So he was an industrial designer and a quite famous one. Why have a lot of us never heard of him?
people haven't heard of him because he got forgotten. And he worked largely, mainly at RCA for 4 decades. And RCA was, you know, a business, a corporation. Many of their dealings were private. And people just didn't know about the major contributions he made to design there, such as coming up with incredible ideas for making radio more successful. RCA was flagging a bit in their radio manufacturing when he went to work for them in 1933. They were growing in their broadcasting industry. They had just built 30 Rock, a major monument to radio broadcasting. It was a new technology, but they were flagging a bit in radio manufacturing. So they brought him on board. He was well known at that point as a modern artist and someone who had created some incredible Art Deco illustrations. He had done some industrial design work, such as creating the turnstile as we know it today. You've certainly gone through a John Vassos turnstile. They brought him on board to say, hey, we need help. We need to make our radios something modern, something appealing, and to really sell them and get them out there. And so he came on board, and he really revolutionized the radios for RCA. He created very tactile knobs. He changed the way that the tuning was done in the radio. It was no longer an airplane or circular tuning mechanism. He made it from left to right. So he made a lot of contributions. He was the designer of the very first television manufactured by RCA, which had a big splashy premiere at the 1939 New York World's Fair. But because these records were held in RCA business history, it wasn't really until those records became available to the public that it was fully understood his massive contribution to the design of television, radio, computers. And that's really why the Hagley Collection is so important, because it enabled me, as the first biographer of this important designer, to really go back and see what he did and the contributions he made for the company.
So you were able to delve into the library's records there at the Hagley, and that was key in your research.
Exactly. They hold the David Sarnoff Library, which is a massive repository of papers telling the story of RCA. And, you know, people haven't heard of RCA today. It was really the apple of its age. It was so important as a leading manufacturer and a leading thinker and innovator in terms of broadcasting, in terms of equipment, in terms of radios and televisions. It was really very, very important under the control of David Sarnoff, who was a very charismatic and important leader of that company. So he came on board as a designer and really helped them grow the company and create an RCA aesthetic across all these different areas of the company. Not only were they, you know, manufacturing, they also were owned NBC, which was a huge broadcasting station. So they had so much power in terms of the growing radio and later television industries.
So how did you first get on the trail of Mr. Vassos? What made the light bulb go off in your head and say, hey, someone needs to write about this guy?
I first discovered his work when I was an exhibition assistant at the National Design Museum, Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York, and I saw a book of his drawings. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he's incredible. He just showed people fear of technology is really what he was focusing on, like an image called dromophobia, which showed people crossing the street, or mechanophobia, fear of machines. He was thinking a lot about, in the early 1930s, what was happening in modern society as the machine age was taking off, and kind of thinking about it in a way that wasn't just celebratory, but also a little bit fearful. Like, what's going to happen in this society when we have so many machines and new technologies? And he was even ambivalent about radio. You know, there was a lot of fears. Radio was used as a tool of fascism in Italy and later in Germany. And there was a lot of questions about what radio was going to be used for. But when he was asked to come to RCA, he really just took very clear notions of modern design. His radios weren't, you know, Victorian objects of, you know, very complex things. He really wanted to take modern design and put the radio in the hands of everybody and make them feel comfortable tuning a station or, you know, finding their way around this new technology, which was quite frightening. So, yes, he's not a household name, but I really want people to understand that when you're in your car and you're tuning the knobs on the radio, that is the influence of Vassos. He really argued on behalf of the tactile, the user interface. You need to touch the knobs. You need to see how they work. You need to feel them. That he really made a huge contribution to how we interact with our media technologies, even today with our, you know, cell phones, and the success of the iPhone is really driven by design.
So he was less of a nuts and bolts guy and more of a design guy. He was really about the feel and the look to make it more accessible for people.
Exactly. So as an industrial designer, what Vassos did was work with engineers and people like Vladimir Zorkin. You know, many consider him the father of television, to come up with, how do you take these advanced technologies and make them accessible? You know, how do you make them, today we say, user-friendly? How can people use a very complex thing like the electron microscope or even a television? When it first came out at the 1939 World's Fair, it was this very large and complex piece of machinery. So what Vassos, as a designer, thought primarily about was, how was the person interacting with this machinery? Where were they touching the knobs? How were they opening the screen, which it was a flip-top television, the one from the 1939 World's Fair? You know, where is their body in relation to this strange machine? You know, he really thought about where the machinery was in relation to, say, the casing. You know, the radios were put in these beautiful Bakelite, very colorful packaging, you know, using new plastics and new materials to really accentuate the beauty of this new technology. Not to make it too strange, but to make it, you know, beautiful. And Vassos was involved in making choices about what colors to use, what kinds of knobs. For the broadcast equipment and the submarine equipment that he designed technology for, he thought about how the engineer would feel in the dark. If you're in a submarine, how would you feel a knock? And he added kind of pointy elements so you could know, you know, where you were pointing. So it goes beyond just aesthetics or making something look beautiful, but also making something really functional. And so that was his job, was to work with the engineers and to make things functional, usable, and really user-friendly.
Quickly, what is one thing that really sticks out to you when you think about John Vassos' legacy?
I just love the 1939 television. He designed four televisions for RCA, and they're just so beautiful. He uses mahogany. He uses, you know, just beautiful woods. He just creates this beautiful object out of something really new and weird. I mean, when it was introduced at the fair, he created a version that was in plastic so people could see the inside. People thought it was magic. Like, what is this? You know, there had been a dream of television for many years, but this was the reality of it. It marked the start of regular broadcasting in the New York City area. So it was really something very exciting and very new, but very scary. He created this plastic TV. They call it the Phantom Television. And in an image from the David Sarnoff Library, you see the people gathered around it, like almost like they're looking at an animal in the zoo. Like, what is this? Like, really bizarre and new. And I just love that image because it just shows people's response to television with such shock and awe. And it just really, I think it is so surprising today when television is so much a part of our life and something so mundane and regular, to think about historically how people responded to this new technology. I really like that image, and I like the early televisions he designed that people rarely see. But I think that they kind of raise interesting questions about what a TV should look like. That was another sort of piece of it. It had no prior form or shape. It was so new. You know, what should it look like? Should it be circular? You know, should it be a large piece of furniture? Should it be, you know, a standalone thing? Like, what should it be? And I think those questions were really interesting. And I liked how Vassos grappled with them. You know, how do you create a form and shape for a new technology? So I love that 1939 World Fair television. And when I give my talk, I'll definitely be showing that slide.
Okay, well, I look forward to hearing you at the Hagley. Thank you very much, Danielle Shapiro.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
And our thanks to Mark Earhart and Danielle Shapiro for enlightening us this week. Shapiro's book is titled John Vassos, Industrial Design for Modern Life. And she'll be giving her talk about her work at Hagley Museum in Wilmington on March 16th. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We'd also like to hear from you. Send us your feedback and story ideas at our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart and James Morrison, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. for all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.